ready? The meeting of the Clinton Township Board of Education will now come to order. Time, Mr. McManus, please.
7:37.
Thank you. In accordance with the provisions of the New Jersey Open Public Meetings Act, Chapter 231, Laws of 1975, adequate notice of this meeting was provided through public notice on January 16th of 2018. Faxing to three newspapers designated by the board, the Hunterdon County Democrat, the Hunterdon View, and Express Times. Posting on the district website, the main bulletin board in the administration offices, and in each Clinton Township school. And finally, faxing to the clerk of Clinton Township. Mr. McManus, may we please have a roll call?
Mrs. McLaughlin.
Here.
Mrs. Brennan. Mrs. Brennan.
Here.
Mrs. Brooks.
Here.
Mrs. DeMurley. Dr. Foy.
Here.
Mr. Malloy.
Here.
Mrs. Olasky.
Here.
Mrs. Redagata.
Here.
Ms. Grant.
Here.
You have a call.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to ask you please to stand for the Pledge of Allegiance and remain standing for a moment of silence for us to honor those who lost their lives in Florida last week. Mrs. Brooks, would you please lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Mrs. Olasky, will you please be the process guardian for this evening's meeting?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Good evening, all. Welcome to the monthly meeting of the Clinton Township Board of Education. Today is Monday, February 26, 2018. Tonight, as many monthly board meetings, we have a very busy agenda. In addition to the normal business of the board this evening, there will also be a special presentation called Considerations and Negotiations, a Review of Preparation Process and Current Economic Circumstances Facing New Jersey Public Schools in Negotiations. Before we begin our special presentation tonight, I would like to bring our attention to school security. School security and the safety of our children and staff are always at the forefront of all of our minds. However, in the light of the horrific tragedy that took place at the Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, a little over 10 days ago, we would like to take a few moments to share with you our continued commitment to school safety. Tonight, I have asked Dr. Pamela Fiander, Clinton Township's Superintendent of Schools, to highlight what we can tell the public in regards to what our district has done and is doing to improve the safety of our children and members of our staff. Please know that in the interest of security, she will not be able to publicly divulge all of our safety measures. The Board of Education wishes to reaffirm our commitment to constantly improving all aspects of how we continue to assess and enhance the security and safety of the Clinton Township School District. Dr. Fiander.
Thank you. I'm going to go.
Good evening, everyone. Good evening, Board of Ed. Recent tragic incidents remind us that we need to constantly reevaluate the security of our schools in the Clinton Township School District. Fortunately, we work very closely with law enforcement officials to ensure that our staff and our students know what to do in an emergency. We work on preventative measures and to remind students that when they see something, to say something to an adult. And our staff remains vigilant in working to meet the social and emotional needs of students so that we can remain proactive in assessing risk. Current security measures that I can share with you, I'm not at liberty to discuss all of them, but the steps the district has taken in the areas of safety and security have been invested with over $1.3 million in most recent years. And some of those include actively practicing fire, lockout, lockdown, shelter, evacuate, and holding classroom drills. Creating a single point of entry at the front doors. Locking school entrances so visitors must identify themselves before being buzzed in. Providing identification badges for visitors, completing fingerprint and background checks for all prospective employees, the ability to view surveillance tapes, working closely with our district resource officer, who we find often in the buildings and is very helpful to us, encouraging students and staff to practice see something, say something, and to notify proper authorities if there's a threat. In the area of training, since 2013, our district has been the beneficiary of a strong relationship with the prosecutor's office and primarily with Lieutenant Kevin Byrd. Lieutenant Byrd has made numerous visits to review safety procedures with the staff and the administrators, and as recommended, we use the standard response protocols and consistently rehearse these in a variety of drills in our schools. In our recent training, which was just on February 16th, Lieutenant Byrd and John Michael Keyes of the I Love You Guys Foundation reminded us of the following facts. An average incident in a school lasts less than 5 minutes. 60% of the incidents are over before the police can arrive on the scene. 20% of the incidents are occurring in schools. A majority of them are occurring in workplace and business. Social media is a strong player in the security incidents. It can be a source of information that is accurate. It can also be terribly inaccurate. Increased signage is important for responders, placing numbers on windows and doors, etc. Also, I found when I came to the township that each building has a BERT team. And I found that BERT means Building Emergency Response Team. And they are very proactive with scheduled meetings in reviewing and updating roles, checking materials and supplies, checking communication lists, and reviewing drills. I'm just curious if you're on a BERT team, if you'd raise your hand. Thank you. Updated information is then provided to the staff at faculty meetings, and substitute folders have information relevant to substitutes during drills, and all classrooms have the color-coded drill protocols on display by exits. As I was looking in the back, I found them by the exit doors there. As for next steps, even with the number of security measures in place and more on the horizon, we know there will always be more to do to ensure the safety of our school students and staff. The following measures are being implemented now. We've increased police presence on school campus thanks to the work of the township. We've invited school personnel to register on the Share 911. We're installing a swipe card system thanks to the authorization of the Finance and Facilities Committee at each front door. We're improving room window and signage so that responders can see exactly which rooms they're looking for. We're obtaining reunification kits, and we will be practicing a reunification drill. These measures are under review. I will be taking to the board a request to look at installing a driver's license scanning system that will alert all school personnel of visitors' criminal activities. It requires visitors and non-district employees to show identification before entering a building. Wiring the district surveillance camera to it so that it's accessible by law enforcement. And finally, I'm going to be seeking a security audit by an outside vendor. Lieutenant Byrd and John Michael Keyes noted in their recent presentation that we are not experts. Unfortunately, they are students. They are students because every time there's an incident, they have to learn from it. And they learn from each other, and then they share with us what we need to know. No one has all of the answers, nor can anyone predict the future. What we do know is nothing is more important than the health and safety of our students and our staff. Nothing. It comes first, even over educating them. Because of this, we take safety and security very seriously. We will continue working with law enforcement officials. We will continue working with the Board of Ed and the staff, and we will keep this at the forefront of our attention. It is a maddening world we live in, but I think we're going to stick together and figure out how we can keep each other safe. And thank you for the opportunity to share this.
Thank you, Dr. Hyander. Good evening. I want to apologize for the color of the slides. In reality, they're supposed to be white and blue. We've tried to fix it for over an hour, and it's going to stay this color, so I appreciate it. I apologize, actually, for this poor quality. Good evening and welcome. Thank you for coming tonight. To help provide as much accurate information as the board is legally permitted, we are making a presentation this evening called Considerations in Negotiations, a Review of Preparation, Process, and Current Economic Circumstances Facing the New Jersey Public School Districts in Negotiations. The true spirit of this presentation is to facilitate communication between the Board of Education and the public, to allow people to understand the collective bargaining process, identify economic challenges facing school districts today, to answer any questions involving the collective bargaining process itself, and to remove any confusion about the facts around collective bargaining. New Jersey's statute does not permit the Board of Education to reveal or discuss the actual proposals or items being negotiated during a collective bargaining negotiations between two parties, unless both parties agree to do so. The Clinton Township Board of Education offered the Clinton Township Education Association the opportunity to negotiate in public in December of 2016, and the CTEA declined. The content included in this presentation will not reveal any specifics related to the actual proposals or items being negotiated at this time between the Board of Ed and the Clinton Township Education Association. The confidential nature of these negotiations will not be broken. And finally, the Board of Education and its representatives will only answer any question that is permitted by law. During the presentation this evening, experts in the areas of labor negotiations, healthcare benefits, salary guide construction will share their knowledge about the collective bargaining process, share statistics, negotiation law, information on healthcare benefits, and later in the presentation, they will provide an update on the current negotiations between the board and the CTEA. Questions that the members of the public most often ask the board regarding negotiations will be addressed towards the end of the presentation. This is how we'll proceed with the discussion this evening. First, we have Vito Gagliardi Jr., Board Counsel to the Board of Education. He will go over the collective bargaining process in the state of New Jersey. Alyssa Olasky, Chairperson of Personnel and a member of our negotiations team, will go over exactly how the board prepares to negotiate in the collective bargaining process. I will go over some of the key considerations that are non-financial that the board reviews before beginning negotiations. Mr. Kevin Malloy, our Chairperson for Facilities and Finance, also a member of our negotiations team, will review the key financial considerations that the board looks at. Tonight, we are lucky to have Mr. Brian Reiser, Senior Vice President, Employee of Employee Benefits of Brown & Brown Benefit Advisors. He will review with everyone the rising healthcare costs and premiums. Mr. Philip Stern, Labor Specialist, Attorney for the Board of Education, will finish out the presentation. He will talk about salary guide structure and considerations, the current negotiation status between the board and the Clinton Township Education Association, and he will answer basic questions about the current negotiations. Often as members of the board move through our community, whether they're in the grocery store, on the soccer field, at musical productions, at monthly board meetings, or on social media, we're asked many questions regarding negotiations. The board recognizes that there'll be many questions regarding the collective bargaining process during the presentation. We respectfully request that you please hold on to your questions until the presentation is complete. Upon completion of the presentation, we'll hold a public comment section where you can ask questions that you might have related to this topic. The Clinton Township Board of Education is at all times fully committed to providing the highest level of education possible to the children in our community. We're also dedicated to being fiscally responsible with taxpayers' money. Within the construct of these two critical and non-opposing commitments in mind, the Board of Education once again reiterates our highest level of respect for our staff and our strong desire to deliver resources that address the needs of our staff. Among the board's biggest challenges is the need to balance the social, emotional, and educational needs of our children, along with the skyrocketing cost of employee benefits, continued improvement to the security of our buildings, managing the cost of implementing and complying with unfunded New Jersey state mandates, maintaining our buildings and grounds, budgeting and implementing capital improvements such as air conditioning and improvements in windows, paying our monthly expenses, including payroll, utilities, insurance, professional services, and first and foremost, working to meet the needs of our staff. We must balance all of these needs while operating under a 2% general fund tax levy. While we are acutely aware of our financial limitations, one of them is that 79% of all of our district expenses are directly attributable to salary and benefits. The board will never make a decision that will knowingly negatively impact the quality of education that our children receive when we decide how to use our taxpayers' money. Our children will always receive what they need to have an excellent education. They will always come first. The board will never take the following measures just to save money. We will never increase our district's class size to exceed state average. We will never make any changes to the structure of our buildings to reduce the number of buildings that we use to educate our children if it will negatively impact the education and support that we deliver to the children of Clinton Township. And we will never make arbitrary changes to the district staff size just to save money. The social, emotional, and academic needs of our children will always come first. As I mentioned a moment ago, the largest portion of the district's budget, almost 80%, is salary and benefits. As a result of those two line items, the board faces its biggest challenges of balancing the needs of children with the needs of our staff during the collective bargaining process. While being fiscally responsible with taxpayers' money, and operating under the constraints of a 2% general fund tax levy cap. As many members of the Clinton Township community are aware, the Board of Education and the Clinton Township Education Association, which is comprised of certified teachers, teaching staff members, teaching assistants, maintenance and custodial staff, social workers, nurses, long-term substitutes, school guidance counselors, librarians, school psychologists, learning disability teaching consultants, social workers, occupational therapists, physical therapists, behavior specialists, and secretaries. We've been engaged in a collective bargaining process since December 8th of 2016 and been working hard to come to a contract settlement. Any labor agreement must ultimately balance the needs of students and members of the CTA and taxpayers. Current economic realities, including increases in healthcare benefits, high salary guide increment costs, and constraints of a 2% budget cap, are providing many challenges for both the board and the CTEA during the collective bargaining process. The board is fully committed to finding a mutually acceptable agreement and within the most efficient time frame as possible. The collective bargaining process is one that is very complex. It takes into account so many variables, expenses, cost constraints, and processes required in many New Jersey state statutes and mandates. As a result of these variables, the processes can be often arduous as we ensure that any one point of agreement doesn't violate statute or mandate. The intricacies of this process, as well as the confidential manner of these negotiations, cause confusion for members of our community as to what is actually occurring. As a collective bargaining process is one that does not normally take place in public, questions arise, misunderstanding and misinformation circulates, rumors and misperceptions about the process, including what events did and did not take place, often transpire. The current negotiations process between the board and the CTA is not immune to this phenomenon. So with all that said, let's move on to tonight's presentation. Our first speaker tonight is Mr. Vito Gagliardi, Jr., the board's legal counsel from Porzio, Bromberg, and Newman. Mr. Gagliardi will present the reasons why we negotiate, define collective bargaining, the laws that govern the collective bargaining process, the pros and cons of this process, and who represents the board during negotiations. Mr. Gagliardi, sir.
Good evening, everyone. Just a few things that may be relevant to the nature of my presentation. First of all, I wanted to point out that I was raised by two educators. My mom was not only a fifth grade teacher, she was my fifth grade teacher, which I'm still trying to recover from that, and tonight's not the night to discuss it. The second thing that may be relevant is that the first place I owned property, and in fact the first place I therefore ever paid property taxes, was here in Clinton Township. When I first got married, I lived here, and I still have an enormous affection for this community, a community whose school district I've represented for almost 23 years. I have not at any time handled your collective bargaining, and I'm not sorry that I'm not handling it now. But that means that with the presentation I'm going to give you, I can't possibly reveal anything that's ever gone on at the bargaining table because I've never sat there here in Clinton Township. So first, why is it that we negotiate? The short answer is because it's mandated by state and federal law. The longer answer is, as Mrs. Grant identified, is that it is not only a very significant, it is the most significant aspect of the school district's budget. This is not an unusual phenomenon. Any school district in the state, the costs of salaries and benefits is going to be by far and away the largest slice of the pie. So the amount of time and attention spent on negotiations makes sense because it is the most significant financial event that occurs in the course of a school district's life. While we focus on collective bargaining as it relates to the economic aspect of it, there are other non-economic aspects of it. That is to say, different policies, basically anything about the terms and conditions of the employees of the district that is not covered by state law or state regulations is going to be covered by the collective bargaining agreement. So while a lot of attention and quite frankly a lot of time at the bargaining table is spent on the economic issues, that is salaries and benefits, there are other issues, and sometimes they can be significant as well, that are covered within the scope of the Board of Education and its employees' collective bargaining agreements. Now, what is collective bargaining in terms of what is the process? Well, the process for a school district is really no different than it is for a company whose employees are unionized, no different than professional sports where the players are unionized. That is to say, you have a team coming from management, which without the collective bargaining process could unilaterally impose the terms and conditions of employment. And then you have the representatives of the employees. Typically, they have unionized, they formed a collective bargaining unit, and then they have a team, typically comprised of the leaders and perhaps others of the union, who sit down with the representatives of management and negotiate the collective bargaining agreement. So the parties are bargaining collectively, each side represented by their duly appointed or elected negotiators. Now, what that means is that not only the negotiations, but communications about the negotiations are handled only through the leadership. And that's why, as Mrs. Grant identified, we are not going to be, because we cannot be, discussing anything that's been taking place at the collective bargaining table, because that process is a process that goes between the leaders of management and leaders of the employees. The bottom line is when they are sitting down and negotiating, what they are negotiating can consist of anything, as I've mentioned, not covered by statute and not covered by regulations. There are certain things that could not be negotiated. I will use an example that I hope is an obvious one at this point in time. If the teachers wanted to negotiate with the Board of Education places in the school district where they could smoke, that can't be the subject of collective bargaining because state law has already said, you're not going to be smoking in school districts, anyone. So that can't be the subject of collective bargaining because it's already covered by state law. So no matter how much you may want to smoke, no matter how much the board may wish to let you smoke, you can't be sitting and discussing that as part of collective bargaining. It's what the law has not spoken to that you'll be sitting down and discussing by way of your collective bargaining. The Public Employment Relations Act is the state law under which you negotiate. There is a federal law, the National Labor Relations Act, and really since the 30s, there have been federal laws and there have been state laws that govern the collective bargaining process. So sometimes the terminology, quite frankly, sometimes the laws themselves reflect the era from whence they come. This is not a 1930s situation where the company owns the mining town and owns the mine and the people are required to work in the mine and live in the town. But some of these laws harken back to that time. They've obviously been updated from time to time, but sometimes the terminology will reflect the origins of laws that go back 80 years. Both the state and federal law allow employees to form a union, that is, to bargain collectively and to use that collective bargaining to negotiate the terms and conditions of their employment. On the federal level, it's called collective action, but the parameters are basically the same, allowing the employees, if they so choose, if they go through a process identified by state and federal law, to organize and then to negotiate. And part of that is the negotiation of the contract that governs the employment. Once the employees have engaged in collective bargaining, that removes management's otherwise unfettered right to determine the terms and conditions of employment that are not already covered by state law, and to therefore negotiate them with the duly elected representatives. And that's the process that we call collective bargaining, governed by these state and federal laws. The persons, as I've mentioned, who are empowered to do these negotiations, and most significantly, through which the negotiations must flow, are the negotiations teams. So individual teachers would not be discussing with individual board members and vice versa that which is being covered at the bargaining table. It's ultimately the purpose of the process to come to a memorandum of understanding, an informal document reflecting what the parties have negotiated at the table. Ultimately, the full members of the union and the full board are required to ratify that memorandum before it becomes a new collective bargaining agreement. Only after the memorandum has been negotiated is it then time for the full membership of the association and the full membership of the board to know and to consider what has been proposed. And both parties are free to approve it or vote it down. If that happens at either end, then the parties are back at the bargaining table. Now, we've talked about negotiations. What are the stages of negotiations? There are five stages. They resemble but are not the same as the five stages of grief. I will walk you through these so you can tell the difference. So the first step, and if the process is successful, the only step, are the good faith negotiations between the duly appointed and elected representatives that I've described to you. If that negotiation with both parties operating in good faith does not result in an agreement that can be ratified by both sides because there are issues which they cannot resolve, then either side can declare an impasse. That's the second step, which basically is a way of formally telling the other side, we don't think the meetings we've had so far have been productive enough, and we don't think further meetings will be productive. That brings a temporary halt to negotiations, but negotiations do resume because both parties are required to do that. If that is not successful, you then get to a point where a third party gets involved in the negotiations. And I want to stress, and part of the way I stress it is by saying it more than once, is when these third parties get involved, they will not and they cannot require the parties to do anything except more negotiations. There is never a point in time where a third party can impose a solution that the board or the unions must follow. That is a common misconception, and I think it's brought about because sometimes mediation and arbitration is confused. Arbitration is a way of solving issues that come up between unions and management, but not to resolve collective bargaining, to resolve disputes that come up when one party thinks the other party has violated the agreement. That's when an arbitrator, acting like a judge, can hear facts and make a decision, imposing that on both sides, not in the course of negotiations. So the mediator gets involved, who basically hears from both parties, participates in discussions, and suggests gently, lovingly, kindly, ways which the parties can get around the issues that they have not been able to resolve. But that's all a mediator is doing. If that is unsuccessful, we move on to the fourth stage, fact-finding. Now, with fact-finding, it's not like a mediator where the mediator is listening and suggesting quietly as part of a collective bargaining process. It's a point where the fact-finder can make decisions, not decisions that can be imposed, but decisions to make specific recommendations and recommendations that can become public, giving the fact finder a little bit of a hammer that the mediator doesn't have. And super conciliation is like fact finding on steroids in the sense that that too can result in public recommendations, but the super conciliator, I think that's a pretty cool title by the way, a super conciliator, the super conciliator can force the parties to remain at the table for a period of time. That's basically the difference, but neither the mediator nor the fact finder nor the super conciliator can impose anything. And super conciliation is exceedingly rare. Once every few years, you have a situation where parties find themselves in super conciliation. I don't know if you're going to take questions at the end or move them on. But otherwise, that's the process in a nutshell, and I thank you for your kind attention.
Okay. Good Good evening. I'm going to speak a bit about the board's process of preparing for negotiations. Please keep in mind that all of the tasks that I'm about to summarize occur before the contract negotiations even begin. This one? Is that better? Okay. Yep. Okay. Overall, the board spends more than 60 hours in order to prepare for negotiations. The preparation process begins in the fall prior to the expiration of the contract. At the reorganization meeting held in January, the newly appointed board president assigns board members to serve on the negotiations committee. One of the first tasks that the negotiations committee undertakes is obtaining labor counsel. The committee identifies potential candidates, interviews them, and then recommends to the full board the candidate they feel is best to represent the district during contract negotiations. The full board votes on whether or not to approve the candidate. Once legal counsel has been approved, a contract is put in place. Next, the negotiations committee reviews the current contract to identify areas that need to be updated as a result of new laws, mandates, or changes in education and the associated processes. The committee then evaluates the structure of the contract and any positive or negative impacts on classroom education. Once the review is complete within the negotiations committee, the current contract is then reviewed with the district's administration. The superintendent works with the negotiations committee to identify areas of the contract to be updated in order to be brought in compliance with the district's policies, procedures, operations, educational programs and processes, professional development requirements, and the length of the school day, week, and year. Additionally, the superintendent ensures that the contract maximizes the level of education that is delivered in the classroom. The negotiations committee then conducts a detailed review of contracts from like districts, meaning those with similar enrollment size, K-8s, and those in district factor group one. The committee also reviews contracts from other districts in Hunterdon County that have contracts that are similar to CTSD. This slide shows some of the important items that the committee factors into their review. Next, the negotiations committee identifies the structural costs of the current contract. These include benefits, increment or percentage increase costs, sick bank, and total salary cost. Then it's time for the committee to consult with the board-approved subject matter experts. These include experts from the New Jersey School Boards Association, as well as the district's insurance consultant, Brown & Brown. The NJSBA reviews the current contract to identify opportunities to improve the terms of the contract for both the staff and the district. The NJSBA also reviews the current salary guide to gain a full understanding of its current and future impacts on the district and its members. Brown & Brown assists the negotiations committee in obtaining information on current and prospective trends in benefit costs. They also provide potential cost containment advice. The negotiations committee then develops parameters and guidelines to assist in getting to a mutually beneficial contract settlement. The committee then reviews all of the data collected with the full board and makes their recommendations regarding the parameters and guidelines that the committee will follow during negotiations process. Discussions occur in executive session until the full board reaches agreement on the parameters and guidelines that will be followed by the negotiations committee throughout negotiations. As you can see, the process of properly preparing for meaningful contract negotiations is long and complex, but also critical to being able to reach a contract settlement that's mutually beneficial for both the staff and the district.
The board would like to go over next two categories of considerations that we look into when we prepare for negotiations. This is the first category, it's just general considerations.
I mentioned to you all of the different disciplines that are part of the Clinton Township Education Association, so I won't go through that whole list again. But the chart that you see up here with all the bullet points are topics in the general sense of things that we look at for each of the disciplines that work in our district. Mr. Malloy will go over in a second the financial considerations that the board goes into, so that's the second category. But I wanted to just share with you that we look at things like the length of the contract, 3 or 4 years, what are the trends, are people settling at 3 years or 4 years. We look at black seal licenses for our custodial employees. We look at the holidays and make sure that they're accurate and current and that they match our calendar. We look at the sick bank process. We look at our professional development needs, certifications for our teaching assistants that are important. We look and evaluate our teacher evaluation program, make sure it meets all the state mandates. We look at grievance processes and make sure that we have the most current ways of working through the grievance process. We evaluate the work day, work week, and work year, and compare and contrast to what other districts that are like ours are currently doing. We look at our tuition reimbursement program and evaluate it with others in like districts as well. We look at all employee leave situations, and that would include childcare leave, emergency leave, disability leave, and family leave. And we look at the stipends of extracurricular activities. Mr. Malloy will come up next and talk about the financial considerations that the board reviews.
Page down? Okay, great. Thank you, Mrs. Grant. So yes, just quick opportunity to go over some of the things that we consider negotiations that are sort of beyond just salary. When you're looking at negotiation in a district, there's a lot of different components, and we'll just quickly touch on some of them tonight. Here's a quick list that you see. Obviously, the comparison staff salary and their impact on budget year to year is probably the largest driver. As Mrs. Grant said, it's currently representing, salaries and benefits represent 79% of the district expenses on a year over year. The February 17 scattergram for the CTA members shows just a hair under $13 million as per signed agreement with the board. Obviously, we have to operate within the 2% tax levy cap, which we're going to be talking about and have talked about. Then there's increment or percentage increases, which Ms. Olowski touched on briefly. Then there's healthcare. Healthcare is a big and unfortunate variable. As everybody in this room knows, those costs do this. They don't do this, straight up. So attended to that is the impact of a potential Cadillac tax as part of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. There's tuition reimbursement expense, and of course, the cost and compensated balances of sick bank. What you're looking at here is a year-over-year estimation or illustration, excuse me, of how our fixed and required salaries and other costs go along with variable costs. And what this really illustrates is just how little room there is within the district to sort of operate on the variables financially. Salaries and benefits, as you can see in 2017-18, represent 79% required costs. Represent obviously 13, we have 8% of variable expense. Required costs being what Mrs. Grant touched on earlier in the presentation, insurance, building costs, things like that. So what is the 2% tax levy budget cap? Well, we've all talked about it for years and years and years. However, for purposes today, the current general fund levy is $23.1 million. We can up that 2% and still maintain control of this budget. A 2% increase in the general levy would be about $463,000. Therefore, to remain that, we can't increase our overall aggregate expense more than that number. If we do, then the budget gets put to the public for a vote. For those, and many of you have lived in this township for a long time, this town does not have a great history of passing school budgets as a voting public. Next key increment is the increment cost of the district. What is the increment cost? It's the total amount of money required to permit each member of the CTA to receive a salary step increase from last year's prior salary. What is the salary guide? The salary guide is the document that is constructed by the members of the NJEA and the CTEA negotiation team. The board is not legally permitted to work outside the constructs of this guide as it presently exists. It's important to know as we talk about this. The increment cost for the CTA teachers is approximately $326,000. If everybody moved up a step, that represents about 2.7% for the entire CTEA population. So this would mean that if we moved up everybody a step, we've got $463,000 in the kitty. That one movement alone would take about $326,000 out of that, leaving us, as you can see, very little room to move for the rest of the budget. The next and bigger item along with salaries is the benefits and the overall current health care benefits. There's various plans here, as you folks well know. The New Jersey Employees Health Benefits Program offers a number of options. It does offer some fairly decent prescription general copay and brand names. It has mail order prescriptions. There is a dental plan. There is a vision plan. There's an EAP plan, and there's a flexible spending account. So the benefit program is what I would consider fairly consistent with what most people get, and I think my colleague at Brown & Brown is going to talk about it a little bit more detail in a bit. So when we talk about the healthcare cost to the district, last year saw a 12% increase in healthcare cost with a total of just about $3.2 million. It was projected at 12%. It actually came in at 13%. Various factors that drive that, as we all know, the population itself, overall losses and utilization within the population, the carrier's overall experience within their book of business, and compliance. So this 1% to 13 to meet the final medical cost brings it up to about $3.25 million. This is about $16,000 over the original projection. Now, just for edification purposes and illustrative purposes, the employee expense is not included in this, but this represents approximately 84% of the overall employer and employee pool of capital that goes into pay for these benefits. By way of comparison to what the general John Q. Public pays, the Kaiser Family Foundation did a study in April of 2017 that showed the average overall family medical plan carried an annual expense of approximately $18,500, of which the average employee paid about $5,800. If you don't have a calculator with you, that's about 30.4%. So to keep that in mind. All right. So our healthcare benefits increase projections for calendar year 2019, and my friend's going to get the blame for this when he comes up in a minute, is 18%. So we're looking at a $576,000 increase on a projection. Bearing in mind that 462 number a moment ago, we're already pretty skinny down. We're now really facing some serious decisions. So why are they financial consideration for the board, as I just said? If you take the increase and the step, we are now twice where we're supposed to be to stay within that 2% cap. So, and these are only two components that comprise the budget. This doesn't factor in the other 21% that we were talking about. What is the impact to our district if we exceed 2%? In order to get it back to 2%, we may see reductions in security upgrades, capital projects. For those who are interested in staying around later, I'm going to be talking about that when I report out on finance and facility. Other areas of potential impact include curriculum development and classroom needs, technology. You may see an impact that would lead to larger class sizes, which is something that the board has stated time and again we definitely do not want to do, because we agree with you folks that it does have a negative impact on a student's education. Extracurricular funding, pay-to-play comes back, funding reserve accounts, and facility upgrades and maintenance. This is, again, bearing in mind the things that we may need to do to stay in 2%. Next area of consideration is sick bank and compensated absences. What is sick bank? Sick bank is a collection of sick days that members of a bargaining unit donate into a bank to be used by other members of the unit who may or may not have used all their allotted days and may be in need of that because they're suffering from a chronic or prolonged illness. The district must pay that employee's salary when he or she uses a day from sick bank and for the substitute employee to that district to hire to cover the cost for that employee's absence for that day. To ensure that a school district can cover the total number of days in the sick bank, we have to add that projected cost into our budget. What you see there, and I hope everybody can read them because they go from blue to dark blue to darker blue, are the costs for the past 3 years of sick bank. As you can see, they're relatively flat. They're averaging between, let's call it $660,000 and $700,000, but that is a number that needs to go into budget considerations every single year. Tuition reimbursement. We pay grad courses, grad and technical craft courses taken during school year. Why? Because the more continuing education our teachers can get, the better they're going to be in the classroom, of course. Here are our tuition reimbursement costs to the district. They're, again, within a normative range, relatively stable. We've seen a few outliers. I think if you could probably throw out 14, 15, and 15, 16, you're probably looking between $50,000 and $65,000 a year. But again, this is an added expense that we have to factor in when making this budget and in consideration for negotiations. And this one, the Cadillac tax. So the future of PPACA is uncertain. We don't know what the new administration came in last year. We don't know whether or not this Cadillac tax is going to stay or it isn't. But if it does, it starts in 2022. It's designed to raise money to finance expansion of healthcare coverage. Whether or not those areas that it was designed to finance will be around, we don't know. However, it would be completely financially unwise to roll the dice and assume that this is going to go away. So we do need to at least factor this in, keep this in mind when we do our budgets for the year. So based on this year's healthcare benefits cost, the Cadillac tax to this district, which would be borne by the district, would be an additional $412,000. So again, these are some of the variable financial considerations that go into our thought process when we prepare for negotiations. Thank you.
It's his fault, people.
Peace it out. Good evening, everyone. My name's Brian Reiser. I work for Brown & Brown Benefit Advisors, and Kevin kind of stole my thunder a little bit, but hopefully everyone will listen to what I have to say. All right, my objective tonight is threefold. Number one, I want to talk about the school employees' health benefits plan. That's the health plan that your district is currently enrolled in. Second, I need to talk about Chapter 78. That's the contributions that you pay. And finally, again, supporting Kevin in the Cadillac tax conversation. As you can see by the big board here, under the New Jersey State Health Benefits Plan, there are 20 plans to choose from, 10 offered by Aetna and 10 offered by Horizon, okay? The first five going across, tough to see, but again, this is all part of your open enrollment package that you receive in November. Those first five going across are what the state calls the direct plans, open access. You do not have to pick a primary care physician. You go to he or she. You don't need referrals to see specialists. The next four going to the right are the managed care products, the HMOs. One offered by Horizon, one offered by Aetna, all the way across. The last plan is a high deductible health plan. With Chapter 78, it's stated that districts must offer a high deductible health plan. So here, every November, employees have an open enrollment opportunity to enroll in any of those plans. The board has not limited the plans. Some districts do limit plans. They say Direct 10, Direct 15, not off limits. You must look at some of the alternative plans. Here, Direct 10 all the way through the high deductible is offered by the district through the state plan. Next, the Board of Education has seven programs that are currently utilized by the members of the CTEA. So in the first, hard to see, but in the first one, employees are enrolled in Direct 10, offered by Horizon, and Aetna Freedom 10, offered by Aetna. You currently have 153 members of the CTA in these programs. I combined them because the benefit levels are the same, as well as the rates are exactly the same. This wasn't the case 2 years ago. Horizon had priority pricing, so their rates were lower than the Aetna rates. Aetna had a problem with that. So 2 years ago, Aetna said, we want the same pricing, so every employee has the right to choose the benefit design that's the same, as well as the pricing that's the same. The second row, again, tough to see here, but you have employees enrolled in Direct 15. That's the second column over. With Direct 15, there's only four benefit differences between Direct 10 and Direct 15. And I'll go also through the pricing in the future slide.
The other plans that are offered, you have four employees and Direct 1525, both with Aetna and Horizon, and then Direct 2030, just with Horizon. And then finally, you have one person that's enrolled in Direct 2035, again, with Horizon. Now, as consultants, again, Kevin pointing fingers and the whole board pointing fingers at the consultant, we want to make sure our boards are advised with future renewals as well as past renewals, okay? So I put this chart together as part of the PowerPoint tonight that shows you 2010 through 2018. And as Kevin stated in his presentation, 13% kicked in on January 1st. This renewal from the state plan is very difficult for boards of education because it hits you right in the middle of the fiscal year. Unfortunately, they do not announce the rates until September, August, maybe September at the latest. By that time, budgets are done. So our job as consultants is to make sure we are well informed and give our boards of education the ammo to build their future budgets. So again, here's a, since 2010 to 2018 history. Last year, again, 13%, meaning 2018, 7%. It's a compounded rate of 159% since 2010. So projected increase. All right, first of all, as I stated, 2018, January 1st, as you all know in the room, your paychecks got hit. The rate went up 13%, so your paycheck compared to December versus January was, of course, different. The 2010 through 2018 average was 11.3%. 2010 through 2018, again, the compounded rate of 159.5. Now, why are these numbers not consistent? Why do we have a 25 and 10, a 13 and 18? Well, the State Health Benefits Commission must keep a surplus, okay? They are well below their 3-month surplus, all right? Adverse selection, the good groups are leaving, and I'll get into the Board of Education looking at an opportunity to leave as well. But every 2 years, boards of education have an opportunity to receive their claims experience, to test the marketplace, to see if they're healthy or unhealthy, all right? We represent 312 boards of education from Bergen County all the way down to Cape May. All right, our job is to make sure groups are paying the best possible rate and making sure that their benefit needs are met. So, with adverse selection, groups who receive their claims experience and they're healthy leave the state plan. Those who are unhealthy by default stay. Okay, next bullet, the legacy. As you know, in Direct 10, you only pay a $10 copay. If you step out of network, $100 deductible for single, $250 for family. Once the deductible is met, then your maximum out of pocket for a single is $2,000, for a family, $5,000. All right? Again, supporting other slides, the forecast is 18%. And the reason being is the very bottom, the good groups are leaving and the unhealthy groups are staying. Let's talk about Clinton Township. The Board of Education did ask us as consultants to receive the claims from the state. Unfortunately, the claims were very unhealthy. So by default, we're here looking at options to the state health benefits plan within the state plan. So what can you do as employees and what can the district do to offset cost, increasing cost? Well, since we already took a look at potentially leaving the state health benefits plan, and by default we can't, now we have to work within the plans. So as you know, by the first slide, there's 20 plans, 10 offered by Horizon, 10 by Aetna. Going from Direct 10 to Direct 15 with just four benefit design changes is 4.8%. Going further down those direct plans, as the state calls it, Direct 10 to 1525, 7.6. From 10 to 2030, a reduction in the cost of 13.1, and from 10 to 2035, a reduction in the cost of 25.33%. Those are strictly premiums, okay? Those are not the employee's contribution being decreased by that. Let's get into the employee contributions. Leads me into this slide, Chapter 78. In 2011, Chapter 78 was put into play. That is employees paying toward the benefits for health and prescription. All employees now have skin in the game. There's a four-year sliding scale that I'll get into in future slides that shows the contribution levels based upon your salary and the year in which the Board of Education is into Chapter 78. Year four ranges from 3% to 35%, and I'll show you that. And again, supporting Alyssa and Kevin in the average Chapter 78 contribution district-wide is 16%, okay? 53% of the staff is actually paying less than that 16%. So here are the charts, all right? And they're busted out by marital status. And I know a lot of you have already seen this. Hard to see up there. But again, they're busted out by marital status. So if you're single, family, husband, wife, or parent child, in this chart, the very top is single. It ranges from a 4.5% in year four down to a 35%. The family ranges from 3% down to 35%. And then, as I stated, for member, spouse, and parent child, they would pay the exact same percentages again, 3.5% all the way down to 35%. Based upon your marital status and your salary. All right, let's get into the Cadillac tax. Again, our job as consultants is to look forward and make sure that our boards of education are not bound by anything coming down the pike that they weren't aware of. So with Cadillac tax, it's been kicked down the road, okay? But boards of education still need to take consideration in looking at this as a large line item. As Kevin stated, $412,000. I'll show you how we get to that number. So it does not pertain to your dental, which you have Horizon Dental. It does not pertain to vision, disability, workman's comp, long-term care, or other accepted benefits. This, what does it include? What is it based upon? Premiums paid by the employer and the employee. So the combined premiums that's charged to the district, okay? Any FSA contributions, any HRA and any HSA. HRA is a health reimbursement account. FSA is your flexible spending that you do have an offering here. And HSA is a health savings account. The cost of the employee assistant plan is also included in this overall number. Right now, again, with this being kicked down the road so many times, the numbers have not changed. That scares us as consultants because they're not looking at this. But potentially, and that's why I put the caveat at the bottom of my slide, inflation's gonna have to kick in sooner or later. But right now, without anybody knowing where this thing is going, we have to concentrate on the numbers that are in play right now. And that's $10,200 for a single or $27,500 for any other than single. So if you're husband, wife, if you're family or parent child, if your numbers for prescription and health equate to over 27.5, we're gonna have to talk about the Cadillac tax with those numbers. So in taking a look at those employees who are currently enrolled in Direct 10 and have the standalone plan with Benicard, I took those two premiums, added them together, have the 2018 rate of for single, $1,145.90 monthly, times that by 12 came up with $13,000. As you can see by the previous slide, it was $10,200, so now we're over. Now it's 40% of that overage. 40% of that overage for single equates to $1,420 for every person that is single. Did the same thing for family. You have your family rate for Direct 10. You have your family rate for the prescription plan with Benicard. See the monthly, $3,225. Took that times 12, $38,000. $1,710, well over the $27,000 threshold that's already in play. Okay, so taking a look at just the single people, which that CTA census that I showed you on slide number three had 47 single, then 122 family, taking the 47 singles times the 1420 and the 122 family times the 4484, supporting Kevin's number of $412,000 if that was in play today. Okay,